Luna, as Private Eye's office dog, what do you think about what that nasty Jeremy Thorpe did to Rinka? Well, we're going to have to bleep that.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to a new series of Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week, in our first episode, we are going to be looking at Jeremy Thorpe and Private Eye's role in his downfall, as recently dramatised on the BBC. But before that, we are going to be looking at accountancy. Don't switch off, we are also going to a party. So, Richard Brooks is Private Eye's tax correspondent, and he has just written a book all about accountancy called Bean Counters, The Triumph of the Accountants and How They Broke Capitalism. Thanks to having someone on the inside, we were able to go to the launch party for this book. So I spoke to Richard there and asked him what's going on with accountancy. I also managed to speak to Margaret Hodge MP. She's the MP for Barking, and for many years she was the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, which looks into exactly the sort of financial dodgy dealings that Private Eye likes to cover. So you'll hear her in a minute. First of all, I ask Richard exactly what the heck is the trouble with accountancy today.
The trouble is that in the last 50 years or so, it's become very commercialised. The idea of just checking the numbers has turned into manipulating the numbers, flogging as many services as you can to the people who should be telling you the true numbers and whose numbers you should be checking. So the whole thing's become corrupted in the broadest sense. And I guess that's why the subtitle to the book is The Triumph of the Accountants and How They Broke Capitalism, because, you know, you see capitalism broken, you see the tax avoidance, the money laundering, the financial crime, the fiddled figures. And that's all because accountancy has become broken.
A lot of people think of accountancy as being the dull and staid version of the high-powered capitalism that we've seen recently. We don't think of it in the same category as casino banking or any of the fancy, you know, credit derivatives, credit default swaps, all of this stuff. And you're saying that accountancy has kind of fallen in with that crowd and has become a bit less dull?
It has, but it's fallen in. It's become part of the system. When I talked to one of the partners in one of the big four accountancy firms about the financial crisis, he said to me that, well, all of us in the system should have done better. And what struck me about that was that he was in the system. He saw himself as being in the system. They shouldn't be in the system. They should be checking the system. They've been guilty of the same excesses as the bankers, for example, but they haven't really been held accountable for it. They've sort of hidden in plain sight. They're there in their grey suits. No one thinks they're that interesting or that newsworthy. So they really avoid scrutiny. That's their great skill. I mean, I think David Attenborough would have a field day with the accountants, you know, probing how they survive any crisis.
Margaret, you and Richard have worked together on various matters to do with tax and accountancy. Can you tell us a bit about that?
He's been one of the most valuable advisors I've had in trying to uncover all the wickedness that goes on among the very wealthy and the big corporations in avoiding, evading tax or in laundering dirty money. If there's ever I'm not an accountant by training. I sort of got into this whole issue of tax by mistake rather than intention. So there's lots I don't understand. And every time I come across a new tricky issue, which is deliberately made incomprehensible to ordinary politicians like me, Richard's my first port of call to sort of get to understand it. And of course, I've used a lot of the stuff that you printed in Private Eye to pursue my campaign on a fair and just tax system. Actually, Private Eye started it all for me, so Richard's story, I've forgotten that, but Richard's story on unravelling the sweetheart deal on Goldman Sachs was really where I came in, because we were having a really boring session holding HMRC to account, and I had a very thick briefing paper from the National Audit Office, and I thought, I don't know how I'm going to get anything interesting out of this, and I just happened to read Private Eye. And Private Eye was full of the sweetheart deal, so we launched in asking questions of the head of tax at that time on the sweetheart deal in relation to Goldman Sachs.
Thanks to Dame Margaret Hodge there, putting herself firmly in line for the Order of the Brown Nose. After the party was over, I caught up with Richard back at the ranch in the Private Eye office, and I started off by asking him how accountancy is traditionally supposed to function.
Most of them make most of their money from auditing, checking that companies have prepared their accounts properly. In most cases, they meet the standard of giving a true and fair view of the company's affairs. Now, these four firms...
The big four.
That's right. These four, not so much little piggies, these four big piggies went to market, and they no longer are mainly auditing firms. They were, but in the last 50 years or so, they've become much more commercial. And they now make most of their money from selling other services, often to the same companies that they audit.
So it's KPMG, Ernst & Young?
Now called EY.
EY, sorry.
Keep up.
Who else is there?
Deloitte.
Deloitte.
And PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yes.
PwC, to those of us in the know.
Okay, and these four have a huge amount of the market captured in terms of doing audits.
Yeah, in terms of the value of companies that are out there,
right,
they more or less do it.
So if you're a big bank.
Yeah, you're audited by one of those big four. If you're any company in the FTSE 100, you're audited by one of those big four.
Every single company in the FTSE 100.
Every single one in the FTSE 100. About 98% in the FTSE 350. They've got it stitched up.
They've cornered the market.
Yeah.
Where do you get problems?
That's a problem itself, that there isn't sufficient variation. It becomes difficult for companies to change. And really, you ought to be changing who's checking up on your books fairly often.
Okay.
But for various reasons, there's actually even less competition than the four, because quite often when a big company has to choose an auditor, there are a number of reasons why a couple of them aren't suitable, and you're really down to one or two. There's an even deeper problem, really. There's just a core conflict between earning money from somebody and therefore wanting to keep that somebody as a client, whilst at the same time supposedly checking they're doing everything properly.
So you can't really say, look, your balance sheets are completely crooked. There's no sense here. You've only got about 6 months to go as a company. Presumably that won't get your contract renewed. They'll go to one or the other.
Well, that's exactly what you should be saying sometimes.
Right.
But, of course, when you're earning so much money and it's going to cause so much disruption to that company, it's going to cost you a big client, then it's tempting to listen to the excuses to say, yeah, okay, you'll be all right for a few more months. yeah, okay, we'll tell the stock market you're doing fine.
Can you give an example of this?
Carillion
right.
is a good example
now,
of this.
Carillion, enormous firm which dealt with loads of outsourced services.
Yeah,
which is pretty vague, but they were running an enormous amount of stuff.
Yeah, everything, prisons, building hospitals, all sorts of things. They were called Tarmac a while back, but they became okay. Carillion, which sounds better. There's always a sign to look for, a trendy name.
Well, it rhymes with million and billion. It implies wealth. Right. It's quite good.
A carillion.
How much have you lost? A carillion.
Yeah, that's a measure of a huge write-off. Well, they were running all kinds of services, building hospitals on pretty narrow margins, which meant that they weren't necessarily making profits, but they said they were. Because these were long contracts, you get into some really tricky questions about how you value those contracts. If you say they're really worth a lot of money, then you've made profit, even though you're not going to make that much money. So
right.
That's the kind of thing that Carillion was doing. It was claiming to be making more profit than it really was.
Okay, so enter the auditors, who presumably say, no, you haven't recognised all these problems.
Yeah, they right? asked one or two questions and were pretty much fobbed off.
Who was doing the
auditing? The auditors were KPMG.
Okay.
They issued clean audit certificates, as they're called, right. while the company put out very healthy profit statements. But within a few weeks, it said, hang on a minute, we found out we haven't really got all this money.
Right. And as a result, of course, we know from the headlines earlier this year, Carillion goes bust.
Other people have to cough up for huge pension liabilities.
Okay, so that's an example of what you would argue as being auditing, destroying the overall health of the financial ecosystem.
Hmm.
You know, there was a safeguard in place and the safeguard's not working.
Yeah, the safeguard doesn't work. It's been kind of corrupted.
And you think this is
a
case
sense.
Across the industry?
Yeah, and they're all pretty much on a similar level. Yeah. I mean, when you see the effects of this are when you get what some people call systemic problems, where it's more than just one company, where it's some feature of how business is being done. The classic recent example was the financial crisis. Banks were claiming to have profits that they didn't really have. There were similar reasons for a number of banks. They'd made loans that were going bad, but they weren't admitting they were going bad. They had these
toxic products on their balance sheet that nobody was looking at carefully enough, or certainly the auditors weren't looking at carefully enough. But they were all doing pretty much the same thing. So you found a number of banks, none of them admitting that, hang on, we're in trouble. And that was perhaps the most recent major failure of accounting and auditing.
So has anything substantial changed since the crash?
Very little has changed. The accounting rules themselves have been tweaked.
Yeah.
That won't make a huge difference. There'll be another reason for some sort of financial vulnerability soon enough. And there were one or two rules changes to say that companies had to change auditors a bit more often. But they can still Right. work for the same company for 20 years. There were proposals from the European Union to really come down hard and break up the firms, stop them providing consultancy services as well as auditing. But they were resisted. There was a lot of lobbying in Europe, and those were not pushed through.
But there has been a parliamentary attempt to break up the Big Four, and this is something you've been writing about.
It's mooted. A couple of parliamentary committees looked at Carillion, and they've said that the government needs to look at the accounting system again, that the competition regulators need to have a close look, with a view possibly to breaking up the Big Four.
You're not sounding very optimistic about the prospect.
No, I'm not. This happens periodically, you get these calls. But these firms are incredibly influential. You know, they're right in the heart of government. They have been for decades.
What does that mean, they're in the heart of government?
Well, they're performing a lot of government services. They're advising the government on how to set up the health service, for example.
And this is where we get into the other thing that you're interested in, which is the other services offered. So we've talked about accounting, we've talked about auditing, but we haven't spoken about this sort of consultancy soup that goes on.
Yeah, this is the big part of the picture. In the UK now, these big four supposedly accountancy firms make only 21% of their income from auditing. The rest is from advisory services or consulting. So they're not really accountancy firms anymore. They're providing advice to the government, to other, obviously to other companies as well.
It's quite a nebulous thing, isn't it? Providing advice. It's quite a hard thing to get a handle on. I wonder if that's possibly why the problem hasn't really been grasped before now.
Well,
it's because it can cover a multitude of sins, can't it?
Yeah, the great thing about consultancy is, you know, if you really want to get a good job, Andy, you become a consultant because you make a lot of money from it and you're not responsible for anything. You've only ever given advice. The person you've given the advice to takes the decision. So you have all the upside, all the money, none of the downside when it all goes pear-shaped, often does.
The last time we spoke, you advised me to go offshore. A bit worried by the advice you're dishing out.
I've got high hopes for you, Andy.
Okay, so you don't really have the responsibility, but you do have the advantage of the work. Okay,
that's right. I mean, you look at some of the major public policy developments now, like, for example, energy policy. We've written quite a bit about the nuclear industry. And a huge amount of the government's advice or analysis on how to shape its nuclear contracts and so on, and whether to build a new generation of nuclear power stations, has come from KPMG.
Who are not the people I go to if I wanted to build a nuclear reactor. My instinctive thought wouldn't be to turn to the accountants. Obviously, you've got to pay for it, I suppose.
Well, you're out of touch, Andy, because they are the place where the experts are. You see, they're so big and they pay so well that they can recruit almost whoever they like.
So they hire a nuclear scientist.
Yeah. Right. They've got engineers, they've got economists, they've got accountants. They've got competition specialists. So they've got everything that you would need. And in fact, when I looked at how they got their big contracts with the government on the Hinkley Point C, which is the massive nuclear power station being built, they made a great thing about how they were effectively a one-stop shop for every service that the government could need. And of course, they also work for the company that gets the contract.
So hang on. That's amazing. I mean, that sounds extraordinary.
Not to me, it isn't.
Okay.
This isn't too unusual.
But they're working for both sides of a deal.
Yeah.
Advising both sides.
Yeah.
I mean, I would presume that there's some kind of conflict there.
There's a big one.
Yeah.
It's not the only one. Do you want another one?
Sure.
The chap who was in charge of energy policy, making the nuclear decisions at the Energy and Climate Change Department when the Hinkley Point C decision was made, left and went to work for KPMG. Having given contracts to KPMG for advice, then went to work for KPMG. He works at KPMG now as a senior partner. he's still on the government's books. He's on a five-year government career break at KPMG as a partner on hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. Normally a move from government to a private company or a firm like KPMG involves applying to an advisory committee for clearance. To say they always give clearance, but you have to go through this process.
Are we talking about ACOBA?
ACOBA.
The Advisory Committee on Business Appointments. Yes, we've spoken about that
before. I think on this one, even they might have said, hang on a minute, you've just given KPMG a load of contracts and now you want to go and work for them. But they got around that by making this move not an actual job move, but a career break. This is the other thing that the accountancy firms are really good at, is finding loopholes.
Loophole you could drive a bus through.
Well, the KPMG slogan is cutting through complexity.
So what's the answer? What's the prescription? There's normally one. You know,
is, if we're talking about having a good accountancy and auditing profession, the answer really is that the firms that do that should just be accountants and auditors.
Right.
So they shouldn't be allowed to do consultancy full stop, never mind whether it's for the same client or a different client, because they have the wrong priorities at the moment. And when it comes to the really important institutions and companies like the banks, the ones that can wreck the whole economy if they fail, then I think that it's time to end the idea of private auditing for profit, because it's just full of the wrong incentives. And it's impossible to ask people to audit really rigorously if their living depends on that client not going down.
Yeah, of course.
So I think in those cases, the auditing should be done by a public body.
Right.
As part of the whole regulatory setup.
But it's sometimes public money, for example, that's being spent on this and maybe being wasted.
Yeah, and we need to scrutinise that a lot more than we do at the moment. I looked at one case involving PwC. They advised St. Bartholomew's Hospital on this huge, the biggest country's biggest hospital PFI scheme. That was costing the trust about £120 million a year, giving them a deficit of £50 million or so. That was going on for years. They were a complete basket case. And then they needed some what they call turnaround advice. And no surprises for guessing who the advisor on that was.
PwC.
PwC again, yeah. And they also, not only did they sort of cash in on their own cock-up, they then sold the hospital what they called a sustainable operational efficiency and improvement program. Just the people for that. For which they subsequently won a Management Consultancies Association award, which they could then plaster across their publicity and prove how good they were for the country's hospitals.
The Brass Neck Award. For
So that's how consultancy works.
Wow. I think I will become a consultant in that case.
Congratulations.
Great.
You've got the job.
Richard Brooks. Now, we're going to turn to the fourth most famous Jeremy in the UK after Corbyn Clarkson and a Paxman, Thorpe. Jeremy Thorpe, for anyone who hasn't been paying attention or who wasn't around in 1975, was the former Liberal leader who was sensationally charged with conspiracy to murder his former lover, a man called Norman Scott. Now, the whole episode has recently been dramatised on the BBC under the title A Very English Scandal. But one thing that the dramatisation didn't make clear was Private Eye's large and central role in bringing Thorpe to justice. The very first mention in the press that linked Scott, Thorpe and the shot dog, Rinker, who was killed on Exmoor as part of the botched assassination attempt, the very first mention of that was in Private Eye in a piece called Auberon War's Diary. And here to set the record straight is Private Eye's resident historian, Adam McQueen.
That was the very first mention of Jeremy Thorpe in association with Norman Scott. But actually, the Private Eye association with it began at some point before that. We're not sure exactly quite when, because no one can place it. But at some point, Norman Scott himself came into the office at Private Eye to talk to Paul Foote, who was the kind of top investigative journalist at the time, and of all time, really, about his claims about Jeremy Thorpe. This was at the point where he was writing a book about the whole thing. So it was sort of 1975. 1974, 75 sort of period, I think.
Okay.
And the idea was that he was going to debrief Footy and we would blow the whole story open. But the interview didn't go all that well because Norman Scott, possibly overcompensating a bit, decided to make a very sexist remark about Liz Elliott, one of the editorial assistants. And again, this is slightly lost to history, what the remark was, but it's thought to be along the lines of, hasn't she got nice tits? At which point, Footy stood up, said, get out of this office at once! You apologise for that. We don't have language like that in this office. We don't talk about women like that. Get out of this office immediately. So that particular story never came off.
Was that even before the shooting of Rinker?
I think it was. Well, the amazing thing about Norman Scott was that he had been punting that story around forever. What sort of gets lost in all of this, and was slightly lost in the dramatisation, was that 14 years go past between the actual affair relationship with Jeremy Thorpe and the shooting. And he, at that point, Norman Scott, who was a great talker, had not only been talking to basically everyone he met in North Devon, which was Thorpe's constituency, where he was also living for the latter part of that period, you know, sort of publicans, doctors, a slightly weird psychiatrist called Dr. Gleedle, who did hypnotherapy on him, his GP, various social workers. I mean, the story was very much out there. It had even got to Thorpe's conservative rival in the 74 election. He had the whole story,
right,
so secondhand, but through Norman Scott. And in the end, chose not to use it because it was thought of being kind of like dirty tricks, really. I mean, at this point, pretty much everyone knew. That's the extraordinary thing about it. Why Thorpe thought it was necessary to take the action he did. Because it was also in the hands of all sorts of Fleet Street newspapers. There's a bit in the drama, you'll remember, where the workmen demolishing Peter Bessel's old office find all of the old letters hidden in the roof. That, as many extraordinary things that seem like they can't possibly be true, did actually happen. They took the letters to the Sunday Mirror. Sunday Mirror chose not to publish them, despite having, you know, at that point, documentary evidence of what had been going on, what was, by any measure, an extraordinary story. But handed them over to Thorpe instead. And this is in addition to, of course, the Bunny's letter and all sorts of things which are locked in a safe at Scotland Yard. So the number of people who knew about it was quite extraordinary. But by 1975, Norman Scott was determined he was going to go public and he was going to do it in his own way. So he had written this manuscript of a book. And in fact, those were the words that he came out with when he was discovered cowering over Rinker's body on Exmoor. He actually said, it's because of this book I've written about Jeremy Thorpe.
Right.
And that was what he was trying to punt at the point, I think, when he came into Private Eye.
Okay, so yeah, the affair was known about and was a thing of the past, but obviously a huge story. Comes
well,
into Private Eye.
It would have been a huge story at the time. It would have been an enormous story in 1961-62 because homosexuality was still illegal at that point. You get the change in the law in 67, which makes it less of a story. It would still have been career-destroying for Thorpe because of public attitudes at the time. But I think the other thing with Norman Scott, he came over as a fairly heroic character in the recent drama. And, you know, he had his heroic moments. But he was, in terms of a source that would come to you with a story, he seemed incredibly flaky. You know, you're talking about a man who had various periods where he'd been in and out of psychiatric institutions, where he'd been on very, very strong medication. I'm not going to go quite as far as Mr. Justice Cantley and say he was a hysterical parasite. But he was evidently a man whose evidence you would have difficult or whose word you would have difficulty trusting as a journalist. You'd want to have that documentary evidence behind you before you went into print with anything.
Okay, so Paul Foote has just kicked Scott out of the office.
Yep.
Where do we go next?
Then we go to Exmoor, or rather Coombe Florey, which is a few miles away, which is the home of Oberon Waugh, who at that point is writing his diary for Private Eye. Now, Bronwell's diary was the most extraordinary document. There's never been quite anything else like it in Private Eye or anywhere else in the press, because it was a mixture of just complete fantasy and little nuggets of fact which Bron liked to smuggle in, or things that he felt ought to be facts, which included things like Harold Wilson being a KGB agent, which there's absolutely no evidence that he was, but Bron kept hinting at it all the way through. But one of the things that Bron noticed and put in his diary was a report that he read in the West Somerset Free Press, which was his local paper, which was the first report on the case of the dog in the fog, as their headline had it, which was about Rinker being shot, Norman Scott being found with her body and Andrew Newton being arrested. What they didn't do was make the connection with Jeremy Thorpe, which is what Bron then put into his diary in December 1975. So this is literally, so I think it's 24th of October is the assassination attempt. So this is just a few weeks afterwards. He says, West Somerset is buzzing with rumours of a most unsavoury description following reports in the West Somerset Free Press about an incident which occurred recently on Exmoor. Mr. Norman Scott, a 35-year-old writer who claims to have been a great friend of Jeremy Thorpe, the liberal statesman, was found by an AA patrolman weeping beside the body of Rinka, his Great Dane bitch, which had been shot in the head. A man arrested on a firearms charge will be appearing before Minehead magistrates when we may learn more. Actually, it turned out we didn't learn a great deal. We weren't going to learn a great deal more, thanks to the efforts of Jeremy Thorpe, who at that point, as the Eye reported a couple of weeks later, was ringing round not only the local papers, but a lot of the Fleet Street papers as well. On occasion, putting on a Scottish accent and pretending to be someone else.
Which also, this is so common to political leaders.
And it's a Trump trick as well. Trump used to phone people up pretending to be his own PR man or his own secretary, didn't he?
I'm sure David Cameron pretended to be a cleaner at Carlton
David once. Cameron famously did pick up the phone while he was the PR man at Carlton and there was a takeover going on to the Guardian's media correspondent. And despite very evidently being David Cameron, claimed that he was the cleaner, which has got to be the least convincing disguise of all time. He said, No, sorry, there's no one here at the moment. No one can answer your questions.
So, Thorpe has squashed the story.
Thorpe is trying to squash the story.
Okay, but Private Eye keeps writing about it.
Private Eye carries on digging away at it, and a lot of that is down to Paul Foote, who wasn't officially working for us at that point. He'd gone away and was editing Socialist Worker, but essentially he never really went away from Private Eye. He was always around and always digging into things. And what you've got to remember is the context of all this at the time, because it was the most extraordinary period in politics. So bang in the middle of all of this, when you've got the trial of Andrew Newton happens, the story about Thorpe is beginning to come out, Harold Wilson resigns suddenly, absolutely unexpected. There are all these rumours swirling around about why that might be and what exactly is going on behind the scenes.
I heard he was a KGB agent myself.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I read a bit about that. Yeah. I think that's probably true, don't you?
So even in spite of all this competition, Private Eye does keep writing about it. And then Thorpe's lawyers write to the Eye, don't they?
Yeah, Thorpe is very, very cross with us. His lawyers, rather, wrote to the Eye and demanded a clear and conditional undertaking. It would cease its campaign of vilification and denigration, which essentially was asking all sorts of questions, not just about his connection to Norman Scott. In fact, not particularly about the relationship with Norman Scott, but as in the case of all scandals, it's the cover-up that does for you rather than the original incident. Mm. So these were mostly questions about Peter Bessel's role in
Peter
paying
Bessel
the retainer. Peter Bessel, of course, paid by Alex Jennings in the recent drama.
Peter Bessel being the Liberal MP who...
Yep, the Liberal MP colleague of... there are two middlemen. There's Peter Bessel, who essentially attempts to sort everything out with Norman Scott, mm-hmm. ends up making things worse because he starts paying him this retainer and leaves a paper trail and various bits of correspondence, which then, of course, stand up the story rather than making the story go away, potentially. Then, when Peter Bessel, who is himself involved in various dodgy business activities, flees to America, another Liberal, a guy called David Holmes, who I think was at some point the party treasurer and an old friend of Jeremy Thorpe, takes over duties, makes them even worse at that point, buys back all the Peter Bessel correspondence with a cheque that can be traced to him when it's well known that he is a friend and colleague of Thorpe's. I mean, this is the most inept cover-up you can possibly imagine. Every single action that is taken makes it worse.
So Thorpe's lawyers threaten to prosecute for libel, criminal libel.
They don't just threaten to sue for the what they say is the obviously defamatory nature of what Private Eye is writing. They threaten to sue for criminal libel. And that is a very, very pointed message, because that very month, the High Court had just given James Goldsmith, famously, leave to sue the Eye for criminal libel, which is no longer, thankfully, on the statute books. It was only taken off a very few years ago. But this is not just a case of being sued and potentially put out of business. You can actually end up in prison. And at that point, that's a very real prospect for Richard Ingrams, the then editor of Private Eye, and Patrick Marnham, the journalist who wrote the story about James Goldsmith, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But Thorpe is very deliberately, or Thorpe's lawyers, rather, are very deliberately making that threat at that point for a reason.
Mm. But at this point, Thorpe resigns as the leader of the party.
The very next fortnight, yeah. It's extraordinary. And it's something that the Eye, of course, marked with a curse of Gnome Spot.
Peter Bessel, the Liberal MP who's Thorpe's ally in this, writes to the Eye with a letter of praise.
Letter of congratulation. He corrects a couple of small points, but yes, it's very pro. What he actually says is, Private Eye isn't just good for a laugh. Its greater value is that it often tells the truth that dare not speak its name. But he also says in his sign-off to the letter, I will do whatever I think right or necessary now or in the future. And of course, a couple of years later, turns up in the witness box as chief prosecution witness.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's on the turn, as we say, at that point.
So it's not clear yet that Thorpe is definitely going to be prosecuted for conspiracy to murder.
At this point, it's not clear that Thorpe is going to get prosecuted for anything. And yeah. This is one of the main thrust of the Eye stories, is pointing out that everyone in a position of authority seems to be bending over backwards not to bring any prosecution to Thorpe, against Thorpe, or involve his name in any way. So it's noted that at the trial of Andrew Newton, who's the original hitman, in 1976, there's a sole mention from Norman Scott in his witness statement of Jeremy Thorpe, at which point that's entirely hushed up. And in fact, one of the points that Paul Foote is making very clearly in all of these stories is it's the most bizarre trial, that one, because there is no question of motive. When the police forces come back and say, we think we've got evidence here to charge Jeremy Thorpe and a number of other people, you know, the Carpet King, John Le Mesurier, not the actor, this extraordinary motley band of would-be criminals with conspiracy to murder, the Director of Public Prosecutions gets absolutely terrified, sends it back for more investigations, even though it seems to be fairly clear-cut. And this is the big scoop that Foote has in 1978. He decides he's got enough evidence, largely from police sources, to say the police think Jeremy Thorpe should be charged with conspiracy to murder. Now, obviously, that's quite a big story. So when he told Richard Ingrams, the editor, about this, he actually took him for a walk. He took him out of the office, took him for a walk around Covent Garden, just to bring it up in conversation. And Richard later on said, it's not every day that the leader of one of our political parties is accused of murder. So any news to this effect was sensational and obviously risky. And indeed, it results in, pretty much by return of post, as soon as the magazine comes out, a writ from Jeremy Thorpe threatening to sue.
At which point Thorpe is arrested.
Just like the Eye said he was going to be.
He then stands again for his seat.
Yeah, I mean, that's the extraordinary arrogance of the man. He decides, whilst awaiting trial, not only to get the trial delayed, which is the most sort of enormous favour that generally isn't done for most people,
no,
until after the general election, but he's going to stand again in North Devon. By this point, he's long since resigned as Liberal leader. And the sort of stench of corruption that hangs around him, even if anything hasn't been proved, you think would be the end of any political career.
Yeah.
But a bit like Neil Hamilton in 1997, when the whole brown envelopes and fired stuff was all over the headlines, he decides, no, absolutely innocent of all this, and I'm going to stand for election. This so enrages Bron War that he decides to stand against Thorpe in the 79 election. There was a lovely little cameo from someone who did actually look very like Bron War in the TV drama. So he stands for the Dog Lovers Party, a better deal for your dog, justice for Rinker. He got a full 79 votes.
Pretty good.
Which probably wasn't the reason that Thorpe lost the seat. I think that was more the enormous swing to the Tories. But he also, in the process of that, yet more legal shenanigans, Thorpe sought an injunction and managed to get an injunction to stop Oberon Waugh distributing his electoral address, which made the point that perhaps this was not a good idea for Thorpe to be standing when he was facing extraordinarily serious charges. And as Bron put it, I found myself genuinely indignant that murder was to be reintroduced as a means to political advancement for the first time since the Tudors. And that is getting to the crux of it. There was also this extraordinary row going on at the time between The Eye and the Sunday Times, who were incredibly sympathetic to Jeremy Thorpe. They were the ones who published the Bunnies letter, Bunnies Can and Will Go to France.
Right, and which is a letter that Thorpe writes to Scott.
That Thorpe wrote to Scott during their relationship in 1962. That, as a phrase, yours affectionately and calling him Bunnies, is fairly hard to spin away as sort of laddish heterosexual banter, but the Sunday Times under Harold Evans did their absolute best. And Harold Evans, who at that point was a great foe of the Eye and was endlessly suing the Eye himself, maintained that Private Eye's whole stance on the Thorpe story was motivated by, you didn't used to call it homophobia then, but anti-gay sentiment, which actually, I mean, that quote from Bron kind of sums it up. It was objecting to a gay man, an attempt to murder a gay man for trying to talk about his relationship. I mean, it's quite hard to frame that as homophobia, isn't it?
So, Bronze got his 79 votes. Private Eye covers the trial, which then leads to Peter Cook's parody of the judge's summary. You know, you are now to retire to consider your verdict of not guilty, which, as has been pointed out, was not really much beyond the actual closing address of the judge, which called Scott an accomplished sponger, spineless, neurotic. He is a parasite. Thorpe is acquitted, spoiler alert.
Yep. And at this point, of course, you get a mass sort of shredding of documents in newspaper offices all over Britain. Everyone's abandoning these enormous pieces they've written in expectation of Thorpe being found guilty. The Panorama, which finally surfaced last week when all copies of it were supposed to be wiped, was abandoned. The Eye, by contrast, goes with a grand acquittal souvenir. There's four full pages of jokes about Thorpe. But what it also features is... That's summing up what the judge said in full, bought for £40,000 by Lord Gnome, which is the original version of what Peter Cook, later in the week, expanded upon absolutely brilliantly at the Amnesty International fundraiser, the Secret Policeman's Ball. This version, written in the Eye by Christopher Booker, I think Richard Ingram was involved, Peter Cook certainly was involved, does feature Lord Justice Cocklecantley, as we called him, saying... We have heard from Mr. Scott, a scrounger, a parasite, a pervert. It would be hard to imagine, ladies and gentlemen, a more pitiful, discredited and embittered man or a more wholly unreliable witness upon whose testimony to convict a man you may think should have become Prime Minister of his country. You may, on the other hand, choose to believe Mr. Scott, in which case I can only say that you need psychiatric help. Which is, as you say, is not much of an exaggeration from what was actually said in court. But Peter, in his live performance, of course, added the immortal line, that Scott was not only a parasite, a crook, but also a notorious player of the pink oboe, which was a phrase which was actually provided, I think, by Billy Connolly backstage.
Wow.
When Cook sort of ran dry and thought, right, I need more euphemisms. And Billy Connolly volunteered that one. So, yeah, a sketch with many authors, that one.
And a valuable contribution to the world of English slang.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Adam McQueen. And if you want to find out more about political deceit throughout history, his book, The Lies of the Land, An Honest History of Political Deceit, is out in paperback now. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Next time, we are going to be back at the Paul Foote Awards. You're going to be yet another party, the Eye's Award for Investigative Journalism, set up in memory of the man you were just hearing about, the Eye's crusading investigative journalist, Paul Foote. That'll be in a couple of weeks. We'll see you then. Don't miss it. Bye.